might help the blind to see,
yes,
and people with spinal cord injuries, that they can recover where in the past. How close is that,
yeah,
to becoming a success?
Neuralink, we've implanted Neuralink in three patients so far who are quadriplegics, and it allows them to directly control their phone and computer just using their mind, just by thinking. It's like, so we call this product telepathy. So you control your computer and phone just by thinking, and it's possible to actually control the computer and phone faster than someone who has working hands. Then the next step would be to add a second Neuralink implant past the point where the neurons damaged, so that somebody can walk again, and so they can have full body functionality restored.
It is 8:05. What Elon is talking about here was in an interview last night with Sean Hannity and President Trump. The voice you're hearing, of course, is Elon Musk. I actually saw a video of a man, I believe he was in Great Britain, who had his spine severed and through technology was able to actually walk. I mean, he didn't walk like, well, I don't walk normal myself, but somebody who does walk in a normal gait and a normal pace. It wasn't that. But the point was he was confined to a chair forever, and he was able to stand upright and to walk through the aid of technology. Dee Richardson has a comment.
Yeah, watching him, he walked very similar to Iron Man.
Yes, it's exactly what he did. Walked very similar. That's a very good point. Yeah, so, but the
but
point is,
walk, yeah,
his spine was severed and he could walk. And it's just with the point of technology. So that's what Elon was talking about, the people that are quadriplegics. They can literally, they've been able to plant some technology where their eyes can control their computer and stuff like that. And somebody, Bob Witkowski, was talking about it the other day, and I can't remember who the person was, but he's well known, who has ALS. And with his eyes, he can control the computer, which allows him to talk. And he was speaking down in New Orleans. Bob was down there for that. But anyhow, in the case of the guy that I just mentioned, I believe he was in Great Britain. I think it was in Europe, but I think it was Great Britain. And he literally could walk. Now, he had it wasn't assisted by anybody else, but he was assisted by technology.
That independence.
Yes, the independence that everybody wants. Right. It's just crazy. And you know, one of the things Elon was talking about before, it wasn't Elon. It was Larry Ellison was talking about with AI. One of the things that they're looking at is that with cancer research, they may be able to create a vaccine that would be, say to you, Peter, your personal vaccine against cancer. And with the advent of AI,
with
and be
AI,
able to do
yeah.
it,
yeah.
literally can go in through AI and do a diagnosis and then right then and there make the vaccine that is specific to your DNA and to your T cells. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but they say they believe
makes
it'll be
sense.
Able to do.
It makes sense. I don't know if you've played around with AI, but every time I get in there, you know, there's these things you see on Facebook. It says take a month off and master AI. I've really thought
it's crazy.
It yeah. would be great to do that. You know, it was like be going into a dojo for AI. You know, I mean, but
absolutely.
You know, I mean, to learn that technology and be able to utilize it for whatever means I felt necessary for my life.
Speaking of cancer, just real quick, I want to give this update. Our friend Dean Ferris was in studio on Monday. Dean just wrote me and said, a quick update for the audience. I am formally in the DLL3 trial. That's down in Boston. It's an experimental trial. The cancer that he has is so rare. I think he said about 1,300 people a year get it or have it. I don't know how you get cancer. I don't know how cancer works. I'm not a doctor or a scientist. He said, we have to go through a battery of lab tests and lots of paperwork, but we have been approved to be in the trial. So, Dean, we're
God
grateful
bless.
For that. As I said to you, as I said to you the other day, Isaiah 60, chapter 60, verse 22, talks about God's perfect timing. He'll do it in his time. And this is God's perfect timing. Peter Boldick is here along with David Jones. Peter Boldick, as you know, is with Rock Mountain Ministries. That is a brand that he is transitioning to the town farm.
So, yes, we're in a transition mode, right?
Yeah, you're in a transition mode.
I love the name. I think it's a great
You're
name.
Transitioning your name. You're not transitioning anything else.
We will continue to do what we've been doing, which is help the sick, the suffering, and the broken. And
that's why this town farm is so brilliant
together.
Because, you know, when we talked about it the other day, and I know the history of the town farm in New England, and people said to me, you know, when I was growing up, we were hungry. We'd go to the town farm and we got food. When I was growing up, you know, sometimes we needed shelter. We could go to the town farm and we would get shelter and out of the cold or out of the bad weather or whatever. Town Farm was a place of hope for people. It wasn't a place of despair. It was a place of hope.
It'll be a faith-based place of hope, which will be key.
That's where real hope comes from, isn't it?
That's correct. That's correct. We had a meeting last night with our guys. It's our weekly God Plus One meeting. And, guys in recovery learn how to BS a little bit to get along. And I've heard them mention it many times, how our program is special and we're like a family. And last night I kind of took them to task on that. And I was like, explain to me again why our these are guys now, some of them that have been chronic relapsers and, 30 years in and out of programs, and what makes our program so special. And to a man, it was the faith component. It was the fact that Jesus was welcomed and in the middle of the room.
Well, how could it not be? Because when Christ is at the foundation, everything is stronger. It's just a fact. Our marriage, people know we've been married for a long time. We're in the public eye. We're together all the time. People ask me, young people in particular, how do you know she's the right one? And I say to everyone, when you meet someone who loves God more than they love you, marry them and never let go.
I love it.
Yeah. We had a young man who went through a tough time. And he called me and he said, because we really got to know him very well through his tough time. And he was very close to my son, Connor. And he said, I think I'm ready to try again. And he said, what advice do you have? You and Didi have been married forever. And I said, find somebody who loves God more than they love you and don't let him go. And when he found that person and he was about to ask her to marry him, he called me up and he said, do you remember the advice you gave me? I said, brother, I talk a lot. I talk way too much. And he said, you told me to find a woman who loves God more than she loves me and not let her go. Well, I found that woman. I'm going to ask her to marry me. And now they're happily married and things are really good. And I just always believe, look, you people in this room know me personally. Obviously, my wife knows me better than anybody, but I am a very, very, very flawed man, and I'm passionate. Sometimes I get hot about stuff, but at the end of the day, I say it every day, I am a faith-filled Christian. I'm not a faithful Christian because I fail, but I am a faith-filled Christian. God is at the center of everything I think.
It takes a while to get there, doesn't it? To get that saturation, that full-on saturation, so you can feel the presence of God in all of your decisions and interactions. And
yeah, I mean, I got to know Jesus when I was 9, but I think for me it really happened in my mid-20s. Would you say, Didi, that's when you started hearing me? I mean, I know when we first got together and I was 22, you were 20, I talked about God all the time, and we had that conversation a lot. But I think it was probably in my mid-20s when I really started subconsciously talking about God and pretty much everything we do.
I think it was actually a little later than that. I think it was after Tripp was born. You know, I lost two kids between the boys.
Right. Yeah.
And that's about the time. And when I almost lost Connor. Mm. That's when it really started, because Connor survived. And I think that was, that's when it really started, like, all right.
I think you're right about that, because when after Tripp was born and we lost children back to back, those were hard days for me and there was nothing I could do. But those were devastating days for my wife. And I needed God so badly just to try to help her walk through it, because Didi wanted a big family. And in fact, what we now know, we lost Connor's twin, which was a third child. Didi was like, I don't know if I can ever carry another child to term. Now, thank God she did, Connor, Leela, and Lizzie. But we didn't know that. So we really, everything just became about God at that point, because it had to. I don't know how we could have survived it, to be honest with you.
I think relationships with our Creator are a little bit like guys in recovery. In recovery, we say some slowly, some quickly. Some guys come to it fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And other guys come just kicking and screaming across the finish line. And I think the same thing happens with your walk in faith. I don't remember any big, bright aha moment where all of a sudden, you know, the gates of heaven were opened up and I felt the presence
light
of
came
God.
Down from the sky.
Yes. No Charlton Heston talking in the background.
I don't remember that either. I just remember always having that center. And I think it came from my granddaddy, to be honest. Even though I was raised in the church, he was very active in our church, but I don't remember him because he was sick when, about the time I could really remember. So I don't remember him going to church, but he was a very faith-filled man. A lot of flaws, he knew it, he accepted it, but he had a very strong faith. And because of that, he had a peg leg from a car accident when he was 17. He was driving a motorcycle, and a car cut him off, and he lost his leg. And walking through that back in, when was that? He was born in 09, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
To go through that at that time was not like.
Like it is today. Yeah. Well, and I think it goes back to what you're talking about here. Dee Dee made a really good point that I hope is not lost on anyone listening to this show. And that is when you become where God is at the center of your thinking, you begin to be able to accept who you are, which is really important.
Yeah.
And then recognize through him you can work on the flaws. And that's a really important point that you just made about your grandfather. Lord knows that's been my walk, is that when God becomes the center of everything. I mean, I do it here. People say to me all the time, David, some of your friends joke to you. They call me the preacher. I don't even realize half the time that I'm making a biblical reference. I don't even realize that. I was the guy that was the Elvis impersonator. Were you guys at that show up at Eric's church? We went up to that. It was so incredible. And I talked to him the next day, and he sang in the choir. And at one point, I made a comment, and he said, I heard how you slipped in Romans 3:23 into there. And I didn't even realize I did it. But my point, going back to you, Peter, and what you're doing is that when God is so a part of who you are, it allows you to recognize that the flaws that you have, whether it's addiction, substance abuse of any kind, whether it's being fat like I am, whatever it is, whatever you're struggling with, it gives you confidence that you can work it out. And I think that that's what you're doing for the people of what will now be known as Town Farm, is that when you're helping them get that foundation in their life, they can see light at the end of the tunnel, that things will, in fact, get better. And they will.
Gives them some dignity, some self-esteem,
right.
Some sense of accomplishment.
And it reminds them, and I say this to people all the time, I don't care who you are or what you think you've done. The Almighty created you. Yeah, maybe Dee Dee and I were the people that were on the earth bringing forward four kids, but the Almighty created you. The Bible says, I think it's in Psalms, he knitted you in the womb. He also said in the Bible, I knew you before you knew yourself. The Almighty created you. He must have thought you were pretty special, pretty unique, pretty precious to have given you breath of life.
Amen.
And you know, when you give somebody that kind of foundation, it gives their life an entirely different hope. And that's what you're doing here. And that's what you're helping these guys realize, is that if God believes I'm so precious, he gave me life, maybe I can figure this out.
For a lot of guys in recovery, a lot of them will get clean from drugs and alcohol, and they get to this space that we refer to it as California sober. And what we mean by that is they're clean from everything except marijuana. And there's a mindset amongst the masses that, you know, especially now that it's legal, that, you know, and listen, I'm not a purist. I think it's a God-given plant on God's given earth, and I think it does have medicinal value. But when you have an addictive personality, it's not much of a gap to get across to start using marijuana.
That's where the gateway thing comes in. You know, people saying it's a gateway drug, but, you know, again, I've been around a lot of people in my life, you know, in the construction business and just in life, that were addicted to drugs and alcohol, and I've helped some of them, you know, not like you do, but you know, have some belief in themselves. And I think that you know, drugs have a way of just, you know, drawing these people in and bringing out their weaknesses. And if you have a weak or an addictive personality, then you're going to go to the next step, you know. But some people do smoke that stuff, and that's all they do. They just smoke it, and they don't go into the next level. But I think, you know, for people that have these problems and these weaknesses, and, you know, I experimented when I was a kid. I had a lot of fun as a teenager. But, you know, I knew right away life is not good like that, you know. So I tell you that, you know what you do and what I've seen other people like yourself who care, and, you know, and the fact that you've been there, you know what it's like to be there and be on their level. You know, it's God's work to see you and other people who care, because a lot of people just don't care. And to have that ability to care and to make it an enterprise that helps those people, that's self-sufficient,
right?
That's the business acumen, I mean, that comes out there. You've really, you know, you've got a great model. I look at it and think, you know, if we could just multiply that, and you don't have any government assistance, you don't have anybody standing there just writing massive checks and saying, here, go play. You're these people are working.
We're earning it.
They're burning, you know, they're bringing pride into what they do. They're exercising the skills that they have within that God gave to them. And that opportunity that you've created for them to be who they are, you know, that's a miracle in itself.
It's extraordinary, really.
It's an extraordinary miracle. Yeah. It really is.
We have two additional new souls to our program since we were here last.
Yeah.
Both have just happened over the last couple of days. And it's a reminder for the shout-out to the listening audience. The reason that we exist is because we're able to earn our way through this.
Right.
And we need opportunities to earn. So we are continuing to look for partnerships with corporate America, local businesses, whatever it is.
Individuals. By the way, someone just texted, do you do chimney sweep work?
We don't.
You don't, okay.
But we know people that do and can refer you.
His network is amazing, you know. And I don't think no exists in your vocabulary. I say can do, right?
Can do.
I always told my kids, can't doesn't exist in the Jones vocabulary. And if I happen to slip and say that word, they're like, Dad. All right? So no doesn't exist in your vocabulary. And I think that's what makes you so special in what you do.
We're problem solvers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We help people deal with issues that come up, and we happen to be experts at dealing with some of the ugliest parts of running a business. It's all the stuff that's a byproduct of what you do that ends up at your back door, and we handle it efficiently and effectively and know how to get the most value out of it before the last place that we go is to the landfill.
Yeah. Well, you know, you think about what you do and how you get these people that are, you know, have been down and out. They need a hand, right? They don't want a hand out. They want a hand up. And then you say, okay, look, what's your skill? And then you vet them. You see that they're going to go ahead and find that right direction that you're looking for. And then you, once they get past that process, then they're out there in the field doing work for you and for other people. And that work helps you sustain. It's not like a massive profit center. It's you're doing this because you care, and it's needed. Society needs what you do.
It helps to pay their own way.
That's right. And so they're independent, you know, individuals that are building up their own self-esteem and doing what they do best. And that's what's really cool, is that you say, hey, look, well, what is it you're good at? And then if someone calls you up, like Dave Jones calls you up, or Pete McVetti calls you up, or Ray calls you up, says, I need movers. I need guys to help me fix my trailer. All right,
right.
You've got them. All right, and then they get to build, you know, up their you know, their
self-esteem,
and but just that they feel good about accomplishing. That's what I liked about construction, is I always could take a raw piece of sand and turn it into a 30-story building. But, the, you know, these guys get to do that, what the, whatever it is that they do best that makes them feel good. And with that, you know, the town farm will continue to breed. Yeah. So I was at 41 now, right? Is that why you had 39 last
Correct.
Week?
Correct.
Yeah. So you're at 41 now.
Correct.
And I think that that's the hardest thing going is when someone hits rock bottom from alcoholism or drug addiction, and they know it's time, but they don't know where to turn. And that's what I love about what you're doing. You're not just helping them find their path to sobriety. You're helping them find their life again. They're becoming productive people. One of the guys you had in here talked about being a better father. That, you know, he was never the father he wanted to be, never the father he should have been, but now he's becoming the father that he ought to be. And
I remember him. Yeah,
I don't know how
he's building that relationship was with his daughter, right? Wasn't it?
Was don't
it
remember.
Sons.
Yeah.
But I mean, so so explain to the public again right now the reason we're doing this is that you're doing work that is so incredible, that is so meaningful. You're not taking government money, so you need businesses out there to hire your crew, so you can keep them working and doing the stuff they're doing, building, rebuilding their lives.
Correct. I mean, in the summertime, the field of opportunities is much greater
than winter. Yeah,
there's a lot of landscaping type of work and painting and fence clearing and different things along those lines. But this time of year, you know, we'd like to focus on our industrial and commercial base in the state of Maine between, you know, Berwick and Bangor type of thing. That's kind of the radius that we could work within. And we happen to be experts at dealing with recyclables and recyclable commodities. That's, you know, that's my 40 years of what I've been doing in the business. And so I've parlayed that into, instead of men helping me recycle commodities, now we're using that commodity knowledge to help us recycle men. And that's the model. It's not complicated. You know, if you're focusing on making your widget and selling it out the front door, we want to be the guys that are helping you deal with your trash and recyclables out the back door. It's that simple.
And you've worked with some really big companies that I'm aware of. I don't know if you're comfortable naming any of them, but some really big companies to show your capacity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the state of Maine in the last 40 years has become more and more challenging. In my time, I've watched the textile business go away. I've watched the shoe business go away.
Yeah.
Pulp and paper is, you know, has been decimated. So we have to get very creative. Yeah, we work for some high profile. Very high profile customers in the state of Maine. And we're able to meet all of the thresholds and all the benchmarks that they require from a personnel and from an insurance standpoint. You know, and I think that's the important thing for the listening audience to recognize is we're not talking about taking some bum off the street that's, you know, rum-dum on a Monday morning from a hard weekend out and having him show up at your business.
Right, I mean, that's the point I was making.
That is yeah. not who we no, are, and that's yeah. not what we're doing. We have a system where we vet our guys, and only when these guys are able to work on our projects at a level to our satisfaction, only then will we bring them outside to work for somebody else. And honestly,
think about
I've never
what
had
that
anything
means
but
to
rave reviews.
Yeah, well, we've heard nothing but that here. In fact, people have called in and that kind of thing. But think about what that does for them, that you send them out to XYZ, publicly traded company, and they're capable of going on that job site, representing you, and doing the work. What does that do for their self-esteem? It's
Absolutely.
Huge.
Absolutely, yeah. And they feel the sense of fellowship and camaraderie, and they're part of a team.
That's being part of something, right? Instead
you know, this
of,
is,
you know.
This is George Bush's A Rising Tide Lifts All Boats.
Yeah.
I think he's the one that played with that a few years back.
Yeah, Rising Tide. Was it?
It was Reagan.
Reagan. Yeah,
well,
it was Reagan.
Rising Tide Lifts All Boats, the dinghy and the yacht. And that's a fact. It does. It lifts all boats. And that's what we're all trying to do. We're trying to create a rising tide in this country for everybody.
The really fun part is it's not just helping some people get their life back. In some cases, it's watching someone come to life for the very first time.
Yeah. See that light come on.
They come into this world, and you know, this is a generational curse, some of this stuff. And they come into this life with a broken framework to work within.
Right,
and
they don't know any better.
That's all they've ever known.
Yeah,
I know somebody that was important to us, and I think I'll leave it at that. Started drinking at the age of 11 and never found a way out, no matter what was tried. So that's why I have been so encouraged by what you're doing, because you're doing this the right way, and you're able to lead people because you've walked this path.
I speak some of the language for sure. You know, as I shared with you before, I speak fluently in alcoholism, and I'm only bilingual in drug addiction only through association because that wasn't my thing.
Alcohol's devastating.
Well, we all know, you know, and I've shared with you recently, and I don't want to get too deep into this right now. I will at some point, but I recently got over a 38-year hurt through the help of God and my pastor and what have you. And that 38-year hurt, I'm not a drinker, so I didn't turn to alcohol. I'm not a drug guy. I've never done a drug. I didn't turn to that. But I am a food guy.
You found your way to the ice cream stand?
And I found my way to the ice cream stand. Handy Andy's or Andy's Handy, whatever it is, on the corner there in Yarmouth, every single day for a solid year, I got a pint of Chunky Monkey on the way home. We lived right around the corner. And, you know, it was... I'll just tell people what
I can only do that once in a blue moon.
I've alluded to it before, but we almost moved back to Florida in the fall of '86, and I talked to my dad about it. Jeannie was so homesick, and I was missing my family, and we were so close, and I didn't do it. And for 38 years, I just felt so guilty for abandoning my parents. And when they got sick, it got really hard because my brother carried the whole weight the whole time. And Jim used to say to me, and Jim, if you're still listening, and we've had many conversations about it, that, look, I lived up there for 5 years and I chose to come back to Florida. And we all knew if the parents got sick, that was going to land on me. My brother's
met his wife from Caribou, right?
Yeah. When he lived here. My wife's the most incredible person I know, but my brother's number two. And he shouldered that load, and he did it with grace and dignity, and it was hard. And I have carried so much guilt over this for 38 years because I was so close to my mom and dad, and we had such big plans. And then I had this idea to move off to Maine, and... I don't know that we ever thought we'd live here forever, but it worked out, and we did. But, boy, I'll tell you, every time I was supposed to be doing something with my dad that they were doing and I wasn't doing, I'd go eat a half gallon of ice cream, and because it made me feel better in the moment. And, well, we all know what happened. When I hit Maine, I weighed 185 pounds, and there was a point where I weighed 319. So I didn't turn to drugs, and I didn't turn to alcohol, but I sure turned to food because... Like, if I was sitting there on a Saturday, I know we're over time, but I don't care. This is important since I'm talking about it. But, you know, I'm sitting there watching a Gator game on TV, something I would have been doing with my dad, except at the stadium. I'd say, honey, my tummy's upset. Can you please give me some ice cream? And it would feel better for the moment. But I did this all the time.
Me, Seymour.
And God kept trying to, you know, the thing, exactly. And
feed me, Seymour.
God kept trying to deal with me on it. And I kept running from it, running from him on it, because I didn't want to deal with it. I just didn't want to. It was too hard, too painful. By the time we had four kids and they were in school, there was nothing I could do anyhow. But the Sunday before we went to D.C., Matt Osgood, who is, I call him 1A. Keenan Eaton is the senior pastor, but Matt is, there's no piece of paper between those two guys on God's gift for being an ambassador. And he started preaching about the mind, body, and soul. And God said to me in that moment, for that hour and 20 minutes, you ain't running this time. You're not running. And it was really funny, too, because I always sit on the end of the aisle. Always. But we sat on the opposite side that day, and it was uncomfortable for Dee Dee and I because we always sit together in a certain way. I have my hand on her leg. She has her arm wrapped in mine, and we couldn't get comfortable. So I literally got up and moved to the other side so we could be comfortable. And so I was kind of trapped in the aisle. I can't stand to be trapped anywhere, but God had a plan for me that day. And at the end of the service, my father's favorite hymn, you know, when I was growing up, he'd be walking the grounds of our home or working in the garden or whatever. You could just hear him at the top of his lungs singing How Great Thou Art. It's always his favorite hymn. Mm-hmm. And they've only done it twice at my church. The first time was several years ago, and then we've been there 8 years now. Not my church, the church we attend. And they didn't even stop. They just at some point, and I'm getting through a lot of this because I don't want to tell the whole thing, but I was broken in church. I mean, I was crying so hard in church. I had tears on the floor below us. You could see the puddle. I was crying so hard in church. because this time God was not going to let me run. I was going to have to deal with it. And so anyhow, I finally realized I was going to have to get up and leave at some point and do this in front of 1,500 people and without explanation. And so I decided I had to stand. I could barely stand. My knees were so weak. They wouldn't lock. And but I finally decided I would stand and sing, and maybe that would allow me to find an exit, a graceful exit. And the song never stopped. It just morphed into "How Great Thou Art." And I knew that that was God, my dad telling me through God that, you know, you shouldn't have any guilt about this. We were close as close could be. We talked 8 or 10 times a day. Didi would say, "You talking to your dad again?" 8 or 10 times a day I would talk to my dad on the phone until he got so sick he couldn't do it. And, you know, they were up here all the time, and we had as good a relationship as you can imagine. But I abandoned them when they needed me, and I was so angry and upset at myself for 38 years for doing this. 38 years.
No, you didn't abandon them. You were close to your dad.
No. But you know, we all had this sort of, I mean, I know this, how this will sound to people, but it doesn't matter. You know, I was the BMOC at school, and my parents were really involved, and we would double date with my mom and dad. My girlfriends would, you know, Dee Dee and I did, certainly when we got together, but we'd go to the Chopping Block, which was the restaurant in town, and we'd walk across the street and go to the movies with them. And no one ever thought that was weird or different. Nobody thought any of that, because everybody loved my mom and dad, and we had these big plans that we were going to do, and I left. And then when they got sick, I couldn't help. And my dad used to say to me, he said, "I know you can't come home." When he was still lucid but knew he wasn't well, he would say to me, "You know, if you were here, it'd be much better." Well, there was nothing I could do. And he said, "I know you can't come, but if you were here, it'd be much better."
Hmm.
We were that close.
Yep.
And I couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to say I hated myself, but I've been mad at myself for 38 years since we had that conversation in Yarmouth, Maine, about maybe we'll come home. Dee Dee is so homesick, and you know, I miss going to you guys. And we always went to all the Gator games together, and all the family fish fries, and all the friends coming out, and all of that. And I just missed it all so badly. And we talked about it, and he said, "You know, things are going okay here. Why don't you see it through?" And so we did. And yeah, we have a wonderful life. We do. We have a wonderful life. But my parents were the best of the best. If I had gotten to chosen them when I was in heaven, I would have chosen those two people. And, you know, it's been 40 years now, but for 38 years of that time, I had just felt like I abandoned them. And then when they both got sick, I wasn't there for them. They were always there for me. Always there for me. And so it just about destroyed me because, you know, like I said, I weighed 190 pounds when I got here, 180 pounds, whatever it was. Do you remember? And I got up to 300 pounds, 319 pounds, just because every time I started to feel the pangs of guilt, instead of dealing with it, I would just eat. Thank God I didn't drink. Thank God I've never done a drug, or I would have turned to those things.
Yeah, you'd be part of our group right now.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah, I think about that all the time. That's why what you do, Peter, is so important to me. Because if I was a person that was a drinker, I would have been part of your recovery program. If I was a person who had done drugs in his life, I've never done a drug. Not one. In fact, Champy, when I was going through my hip problem, I couldn't deal with prescription drugs. They didn't work on me. And they, you know, when he said to me jokingly, "You know, if you'd have just done drugs like everybody else did, you might not be so resistant." But so if I had been a person prone, he was joking.
Yeah, I know.
But I was so resistant to every drug that he gave me, it didn't work. So, but if I had been a person that did drugs, I would have become addicted because that's my personality. And whatever I care about, I'm addicted to. And so I'm grateful that I didn't do those things, but I went to food, which was so bad. And I've been lucky it didn't wreck my health. I've been really lucky. But thankfully, thanks to Matt Osgood and to Keenan Eaton, who was sitting behind me, and he's never done that before, he recognized something was going on. And Keenan Eaton put his hands on my shoulders and just sort of rubbed them like my dad would have done as I was literally kneeled over praying, crying my eyes out, literally a puddle of water on the floor at the church. And God said, through my dad said through God, no, we had a great life. when that How Great Thou Art came on, I knew it was a message from God that it was okay and that I needed to let it go. And I will tell you, and Dee Dee will verify this, my life has been so different in the last 5 weeks.
This is the first time you've shared this story.
Yes, publicly, yes.
Wow.
I did share it with my son, Connor, because there's a piece there. I thought I was upset. Remember when I went through that dark period?
Right.
I thought that was when Connor left, you know, and moved to Florida. And I thought I was upset with his friends who were questioning whether he was doing the right thing. And then I realized on that Sunday that was no way that was true. They were just being good friends. They were doing what any good friend would do when somebody's making a big decision and saying to him, you know, are you doing the right thing? Have you really thought this through? And when I realized I wasn't upset with them, then I thought, well, my God, my son abandoned me. I have to be upset with Connor. And I wasn't. I encouraged Connor to do this because that's what we had done. And so when I realized, and this all happened in the church service, this all happened in an hour and 20 minutes. When I realized that I wasn't upset with Connor, that's when the waterworks really went. I had tears in my eyes, but I mean, I just, because I realized God was not letting me go. I had run from God on this issue for 38 years. And I know we got to go here, but finally he made me recognize that the person that I was upset with was myself. And the catalyst was, is that Connor did what I did. And it made me deal with it finally.
It's like the Harry Chapin song.
Yeah.
My boy is just like me.
Absolutely.
Cats in the cradle.
Yes,
that's it.
Absolutely. You know, yeah. And so finally God just said, you're not running this time. We're gonna deal with this. And he would not let me go. He would not let me go. And I wasn't sure how I was going to get out of church, much less figure this all out. But in the space of that hour and 20 minutes, and I called Matt Osgood, and I also met with Kenan, and I told them how grateful I was to them, because in that moment, they were God's ambassador to me to make this finally work itself out. And my life has just been so different. I'm not burdened by this guilt. I'm not burdened by
it. Your father and your mother wouldn't want it.
No, I know. They would never. Yeah. And they would never. And actually, yeah, having that guilt was a disservice. My dad, I know he was proud of me. I won't get into how I know all that, but I know he was, because of things that he said and did with other people. And they would tell me about it. But and it was like he said to me, I encouraged you. Your mother and I prepared you and your brother to do whatever it was that your life told you you should do. My mom, I've talked about it before. We had Manners Week in our house, and my mom used to say, finally, when we were older, it was fun because we always had this great food and we had to learn how to eat it properly. So it would, you know. And I finally said to her, why do we keep doing this? And she said, my boy, I don't know whether you're going to end up in the soup kitchen or the White House, but I want you to know that wherever it is you are, that's where you're supposed to be. And I want you to be prepared for it. So they always encouraged me to do whatever it was that I believed I would do, could do. And, you know, the truth of the matter is my parents taught me that I could do anything if I was willing to work for it. And I believed it. It wasn't just that they taught me these things. I believed it. So
as you should.
I would be in your program right now if I had turned to drugs or alcohol. I turned to food to salve the hurt that was in my heart. And thankfully, God wouldn't let me go this time, and that hurt is gone. And there's nothing I can do about it now because they're both dead and gone. But at least I don't carry that burden now.
What a release. 38 years to carry
38
that.
38 years from the fall of October of 2000, the fall of 1986. 38 years. We were standing on the front lawn out in Yarmouth, Maine, and I said, Dad, Dee Dee is so homesick. We love it here, but she's so homesick. And, you know, I miss not doing all the stuff we always did. And I never even told her about that until 5 weeks ago when we were driving down to D.C.
I think you made the right decision. Maine is a great place to be.
Yeah, I
made that same
for
decision. My kids
year,
are all
Dave,
here.
And,
you know, huh?
For 10 months out of the year, I agree.
Yeah. No, it was all 12 months out of the year. It's all good.
How do people find out more?
Very easy. Give us a shout at 797-7997. That's the number to the office. My lovely bride will pick up the phone and direct you accordingly.
We have got to run. Noel is waiting on the other end. And probably has no idea what's going on as he's listening on the other end. So we've got to run. Peter, it's great to see you. David, I know you're headed out as well. Gentlemen,
take
pleasure.
Take care, guys. Right.
797-7997.
You got it, brother.
You got it. All right, guys. We'll see you next week. We're going to transition right now. Noel, I apologize for the lateness. Noel, the director of the AARP in the state of Maine. Good morning.
Good morning, Ray. No, please don't apologize. I mean, that was very... the storytelling there, the personal story you were sharing was very touching, very real. So,
and I know you've dealt with some of that because your father lives out in Hawaii, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so I know you've dealt with some of that as well. But, you know, I guess we do the best that we can with the life we're given, right?
That's right, still dealing with it. And you know, it's quite profound how all of us have these intense big stories behind us, behind what we present at work and to others in life, and everyone has a story to tell, and everyone's story is so important.
That's why I encourage everybody to write a book about who they are, because everybody has a story to tell and we can learn from those things, and they're really important. And you know, everybody that's listened to this show and everybody that knows me personally knows how much I love my mom and dad and how grateful I am that God gave me them as parents. But they probably didn't know the guilt I had been dealing with all these years for having left Florida and come to Maine and not been there for them when they needed me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, don't be, please. And speaking of storytelling and people's stories and what people have to say, I'm hoping we can talk about AARP's recent Vital Voices survey that we just did in the state.
Yeah, I think it would be really good if we moved on from this, because I think you or I both are going to have a really emotional reaction if we keep on. So why don't we do that?
Yep, that sounds good. But I just want to say one quick thing before we move on to the Vital Voices survey. I think whoever your guest was, you know, kind of said, like, this is probably the first time you're telling the story the way you are. And I think it's so important to tell the story. So I'm glad you did. And I'm glad I could hear your story and know a little bit more about you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I had planned to tell it at some point. And Peter Boldick, who runs Rock Mountain Ministries, who are helping people with addiction, we got into that. And then, you know, commonly we look at addiction as drugs or alcohol. But the truth is, in my case, it wasn't drugs or alcohol. I've never been drunk. I've never done a drug. But it was absolutely food. And I gained over 100 pounds living in Maine, because every time I'd go to feel guilty and hurt, I would start eating something I probably should not have been eating, and I would consume a lot of it.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah. Yep. All right. It's hard to transition from that story.
I know, right? and I apologize, because you do have some important stuff you want to tell.
But let's talk about Vital Voices survey. Every 3 years, AARP does a state-specific survey and interviews, surveys of pretty good sizable sample of you know, people living in the state, and in our case, Mainers, and ask a whole set of questions around what is really, you know, big on their minds, what is really, you know, emerging as an issue that they're really concerned about. And so we just released that survey late last year, and so there's Maine-specific data about older adults and what they are concerned about, what they're thinking about, and some of that data, you know, which we're hoping lawmakers and other folks who are in positions of power will kind of look at and really take a very close look at and do something with it, because it's very powerful what we've learned through the survey. And, you know, and it really and the questions really range from housing, you know, pocketbook issues, utilities, what are you most concerned about? And, you know, broadly speaking, about 70%, you know, say that providing care for a loved one, kind of building on the topic we're talking about, providing care for a loved one is, you know, is part of their reality, and they've either done it in the past or are doing it currently, and that's 70% of everyone who was surveyed. And then about 87% say it's extremely or very important to be able to stay in their own home as they get older. And that is something that, you know, in a state where we're seeing shutdowns of nursing homes and you know, services, in that there aren't enough services for people, especially those living in rural parts of the state, that's a big thing. I mean, if you think you want to stay at your home that you built, that you've nurtured, that you know the community that you've really supported for probably decades in many cases, that you want to stay there as long as you want. And that's where you have your social network. That's where you have your moral support. And then about 81% say that the increase in electricity bills would be a problem for them. Yeah. That they cannot.
If I can just pause you for a second, I want to go back to something you were talking about. And that is about everybody wanting to stay in their homes. And I think that, and I've had, you know, I spend my life thinking. In fact, you know, I'm awake a good deal of the night thinking. And one of the things is I've gone through what I've recently been able to deal with. One of the hardest things in the world that happened in my family's life was my mom and dad had promised each other they'd lived in the same home for 50 years, a beautiful place on the lake, and that they would never allow the other one to go into a nursing home. And when my father, who was a pretty good-sized guy, when he got to a point where my mother just didn't have the ability to care for him because they lived out in the country, he would fall, and she'd have to end up calling, you know, the fire department to come help him get up because she couldn't physically do it. When she finally accepted the fact that he had to go to a nursing home, for one solid year, she cried herself to sleep for breaking the word to the man she had been married to for over 60 years. I think that that's something often when people aren't able to stay in their home, that's an element that you don't see, that's an element that we don't talk about. But when the person's in the nursing home, that's difficult. They're no longer in their surroundings. But the person that's left at home are left devastated because often they do make those kinds of promises.
That is so true. I mean, you could be talking about my parents. My mother is guilt-ridden right now because my dad is not at home. And in fact, yesterday he just transitioned to hospice care.
And, I'm sorry
and
to hear
she
that.
She is really devastated that she hasn't done enough and she couldn't keep him at home any longer. And I think what the respondents to the survey are saying, I don't think they're saying they want to stay at home beyond the stage where they cannot stay at home. But I think most people, I'm sure you and I too, would say the same thing. We want to stay at home as long as we possibly can.
Sure.
You know, and because that's the most comfortable place for us to be. And the guilt piece is so, I'm so glad you brought that up, because a lot of people don't talk about the guilt that caregivers carry when they're not able to do enough, you know, for physical reasons. You know, in some cases, as you get older and your spouse, your partner, or your child needs physical support and you're not able to give that kind of support, that's a challenge. Emotional support sometimes, or not knowing how to really work with someone who's dealing with dementia, and just kind of people transferring into different states of mind, and as a caregiver, you don't know how to support them, and financially as well. Right? I mean, if there are things you have to do as a caregiver to take care of your loved one, sometimes you have to make modifications to your home. Other times, you have to pay for transportation to bring your loved one to the appointments that they need to be at, and you may not be able to do it by yourself anymore,
right,
because of the kind of, you know, state that your loved one is in. So all of these things are very real for a caregiver. In addition to actually providing care for your loved one, there are all these extra added elements. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Well, and you brought up the point. That's where people are most comfortable. There's an old saying, we all know it, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. And that's what we all feel, no matter what your home is, whether it's a castle or whether it's a place where the walls are barely staying up. It's yours. It's your place. It's where you spent your life with the person you love the most, and that's where you want to be. And so it is hard when that person goes, but it's even harder on the spouse that's left behind. often, and in my case, and you said your mom is going through this, and I'm very sorry that your father is in hospice. You have shared with us over time how you've gone out to Hawaii as often as you could, and being, you know, this far away, I was 1,500 miles away. You're, what, 5,000 miles away. I can relate to everything that you are going through right now, so my heart goes out to you on this. But, you know, it's also your mom. You said your mom was going through a lot of guilt over this. That's what my mom went through. It took her literally. My brother is such a warrior for our family. It's just I can't even begin to describe the kind of man my brother is. I don't think there are even words for it. But how he supported my mom, he and his wife Jane, she's a wonderful lady as well, and but supported my mom through all of this, and it's hard, you know. My daughter Lizzie, who's my youngest child, has said to me so many times, "Dad, you never told me adulting sucks." And you know, it's wonderful, but it's hard.
It's very hard. Very, very hard. Yeah. And you know, and then when it comes to and there are other things, right? Life doesn't stop. You have to pay your utilities. You have to pay your taxes. You have to, you know, cook and all of that. And you know, the other thing that's really profound that kind of really stood out for us is that 51% of Maine residents, you know, those who were surveyed, said that state government should limit electricity rates, and that they really need to do something. And another 65% say that state officials are not doing enough to keep electricity rates affordable. I mean, that's a large number of people who really think that our lawmakers are not doing enough to really control, to ensure affordable electricity for all Mainers. And I think, and that's a pocketbook issue, right? I mean, it's right. Big stuff that people have to decide. Am I going to heat my home, or am I going to really, you know, have the prescription pills today, or should I spread it out so that I can actually save $12 that I can then pay for heat and maybe turn up the heat thermostat by one, you know, by a notch, right? And so these are things that I think Mainers today are really grappling with. And a majority of them say that they cannot keep up with another increase in the electricity bill, that they might, you know, they might not be able to live in their homes if their taxes go up any higher.
Yeah.
That's about 91%. Another 88%, if their rent goes higher, they cannot live in their homes. And another, I think it was somewhere around 65%, and I'm off. I'm really not entirely certain on this number that I'm quoting right now. Is I think 61 or 65% said that the electricity bill goes up, that they will not be able to live in their home anymore.
Well, I mean, in my hometown of Westbrook, last year we got a huge tax increase, property tax increase, on top of the huge property tax increase the year before. I have the names of 203 families. They're seniors who live in their home. Their home's paid off. And they've reached out to me and said, I don't know what I'm going to do when it comes time to pay this bill. I don't want to get my house leaned. My credit's good, but we don't have the money. And I don't know what they're doing. I've tried to stay in touch with them as this process has gone on over the last 6 months. But they've said they're going to have to leave the homes. In some cases of these 203 families in my hometown of Westbrook, they were raised in the home that they raised their family in, and it's devastating to them. But the property taxes are out of control in the state of Maine. I think we all know that, which is why I'm hoping at some point we're going to find a way to bring everybody together for the things we do agree on. There's still going to be issues that we don't agree on. I'm sure if you and I sat down for a cup of coffee, we'd find things we could disagree on. But I'll bet you there's a whole lot of stuff we could agree on. And if we just worked on that, we could solve some real problems for people that are struggling.
That is so true. That is so true. And I'm actually looking up at the results of the survey. It's actually 89%, not 61 or 65%. That said, that if their utility costs go up, they will not be able to remain in their home as they age.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's incredible, yeah.
I hate to do this because I've appreciated this conversation so much, and certainly my heart goes out to you. I will pray for your family, and I know your mom is dealing with some pretty tough days right now, and I don't know what your faith is, and I'm not asking you to tell me, but I will tell you that in my mother's case, it was her faith that got her through it, her faith in my brother. So
how fortunate for her.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
And I think I'd like to come back again because there's just so much in this survey that's made.
Yeah, no, we can do that.
We can talk more about it.
And I know we got off track here, and I don't even know how it happened, but wasn't something I planned to do today to talk about this, but, you know, whatever led me to do it. So my heart goes out to you as your father is dealing with hospice, and your family will be in my prayers.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Great to talk with you. Noel, the state director for the AARP. We will be right back. Just bear with us just a moment. Here we go.
WLOB Portland, WLOBradio.com, and 100.5 WLOB.
Accept a peace deal if they had no part in negotiating it.
Hamas has a new offer to Israel negotiating phase two of the ceasefire there. They'd free all the remaining hostages at once if